That's great. The recording has started. Good afternoon, Shmuel Plotzker, Golf Manor Synagogue, coming at you live from our School of Jewish Studies. We're going to continue our study right now of Sefer Eim HaBanim Smecha. It's been a pleasure learning all this with you. We're on page 272. That's a lot of pages by anybody's estimation. If you've missed us in the past, if this is your very first encounter with us, that's great. We welcome you. Try to catch up. It's only been a couple of years that we've been doing the book. Trying to meet every single week. We do an hour at a shot, so we've got a lot of shiurim already out there. Hopefully you'll enjoy this one. I got to get somewhere with my little kid this afternoon at a certain time, so we're going to end ever so slightly earlier. We'll do 50 minutes. Let's get started as a result. Page 272, on the very top, where the paragraph begins, the first full paragraph, in the margins it says in bold, we must not rely on miracles. And the Hebrew, the letters Chaf Aleph, corresponding to the numbers 21 in Hebrew. Thus, we must not rely on miracles alone, Rabbi Teichtal writes. We must not rely on miracles alone. That alone is a very, very big statement. Instead, he writes, we must do what we can, naturally, and then Hashem will send us assistance from the heavens. I will prove this from a letter that our mentor, the Rambam, wrote to the scholars of Marseille regarding astrology. And the citation for this letter is Igros Uchuvos L'Rambam, Igros Shonos, or Igros Shonot, page 21. Excuse me, so he's writing a letter to the scholars of Marseille in France. And he writes, says Rabbi Teichtal, first, the Rambam tells them that astrology books have no content, are absolutely foolish, and that he who studies them simply wastes his time and gains nothing. Afterwards, Rambam writes, quote, this is what abolished our kingdom, destroyed our Beis HaMikdash, prolonged our exile, and brought us to our present predicament. Our fathers sinned and are no more. That's a pasuk in Eicha, Lamentations chapter 5, verse 7. For they found many astrology books, followed them, and went astray. They imagined that these wisdoms were glorious and greatly beneficial. And they didn't study warfare and land conquest. That's in bold by the editor. Instead, they, meaning the Jewish people of old, they imagined that these wisdoms would help them. Therefore, the prophets called them fools. And they certainly were fools, for they followed vanities which cannot avail nor rescue, for they are vain. And that pasuk is based on those words, based on a pasuk in Shmuel, 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 21. End of the quote. Thus our master, the Rambam, blames our ancestors for the destruction of our land and our temple because they didn't study warfare and land conquest. Instead, they wasted their time and relied on vanities and nothingness. Now, why did he not blame them for their failure to study Torah and serve God properly? Why wasn't that the real reason given? The answer must be because that alone is insufficient. In other words, it's bad to not study Torah, and it's bad to not serve God properly. All that is true. But that alone won't get you destruction of the temple. Not studying Torah and not serving God properly, there are nobody's idea of putting you on the straight and narrow towards Hashem. But Hashem will also not wreck your Beis HaMikdash if that's all the bad that you do. It's insufficient. What they wound up doing is studying astrology, according to this, wasting their time and not and relying, therefore, on vanities and nothingness. When they could have been, obviously, they were studying Torah, but they could have done much more practical stuff. They could have studied warfare and land conquest, writes the Rambam. It's an amazing thing. The Ramban writes in many places that we must not rely on miracles. Rather, we must do whatever is humanly possible, and then God will send us heavenly assistance. See the Ramban on Vayikra, Leviticus, chapter 21, verse 17, Bamidbar, Numbers chapter 1, verse 45, chapter 13, verse 2. Do whatever is humanly possible, and Hashem will send you heavenly assistance. People, I see it in my own life, and you'll see it in yours. All you got to do is get out there and do, and you'll see that Hashem will bless you. The Rashba concurs. Take a look at the Tshuvas of Rashba 419. The Rashba concurs, as does the Midrash on the verse, in Hashem lo yivne vayis shav amlu vonav bo. If Hashem will not build a house, its builders labor on it in vain. That's a pasuk in Tehillim in Psalm 127, verse 1. The Midrash explains that this does not mean that a person should do nothing and rely solely on God to build his house. Can you imagine that? I'm not going to build my house. Hashem will build my house. I'm going to sit here and watch Hashem build my house. Boy, you will be watching till you go into a box. God forbid you should be well. I mean, that is the craziest way to live your life. I'm going to just sit back and let God do it all. Hashem says, I thought that's what I put you on the earth for, to do some work. Oh, no. I'm going to just sit back here. You do all the heavy lifting. You, oh God, carry the freight. I will watch with great satisfaction as you do all the hard work. Hashem says, there's got to be something wrong with this paradigm. What is wrong with this picture? I put him on earth to work, and he sits back and he waits for me to do all the work. Yeshikayach. Not going to work like that. Oh, yeah, yeah. But that's how we are. The Midrash explains, again, it doesn't mean that a person should do nothing and rely solely on God to build his house. It means that when a person works and toils, and that's exactly what he better do, then he shouldn't rely on his work alone. Don't only rely on your own work and you therefore ignore God. Don't do that. Don't ignore God. Get him involved in it. Should not rely on your work alone. Page 273 at the top. Don't rely on your work alone, because if you do that, then shav amlu vonav bo. Then the builders are laboring on the project in vain. Won't get done. Instead, he should rely on God's heavenly assistance. This can be inferred directly from the pasuk. Shav amlu vonav bo. Its builders are laboring on it in vain. The implication is that there's somebody building it. Somebody is toiling and building. That's what the pasuk says. But if Hashem is not involved in your planning, if you don't invoke Hashem, you don't invite him into the project, you don't ask him for his grace and his blessing, well, you're going to be wasting your time. The implication is there's somebody toiling and building. The only qualification is that one should not rely on his toil alone, but put his trust in God. See Midrash Tanchuma, Parshas Pekudei 8, either page 8 or chapter 8. See over there. The Buber edition. Still on page 273. First full paragraph. The Yerushalmi states that the Jewish people studied Torah and kept mitzvos at the time of the Second Temple. Take a look at Yuma, chapter 1, Halacha 1. And it'll be explicated on page 4b in Yuma. Thus, the reason the land and the temple were destroyed was not because they lacked the merit of Torah and mitzvahs. They had it. It must be, as the Rambam states, that they relied on vanities and didn't engage in the natural activities that were needed for the land to subsist, like the study of warfare and land conquest. This caused the destruction of the land and of the Beis HaMikdash. So the people were learning Torah. The people were doing mitzvahs. But they were not engaged, according to this, in natural activities that were necessary for the land to get along, to subsist, like the study of warfare and land conquest. You know, the truth is, by the time the Second Temple was destroyed, the Romans had already been in the country for decades and decades. I think that they came in, let's see, the Hanukkah story took place 160 or so before the Common Era. I thought I heard that lasted 100 years, the Hashmonaic kingdom. So in around the year 60, the Romans came in. And by the year 70 of the Common Era, they destroyed the temple. If you can count, it's 60 plus 70. That's 130 years that the Romans were in the land of Israel and had been, you know, physically in charge of the place. I'm not sure how much study of warfare and land conquest they could have done. And even if they had studied it, I'm not sure what that would have done for them. Forgive me. I'm sorry. It's not the company. I just need more oxygen. He's going to make that point later about, you know, studying warfare and land conquest. When you're not able to do warfare and land conquest, what does it mean? I think that's the same question over here. They were under Roman, you know, rule. So let me write that down. They were under Roman rule. So how much land conquest and warfare could they have done? All right. At all events, he writes, this caused the destruction of the land and the Beis HaMikdash. Middle of the page, 273. The Rambam, as stated above, also states that this is the reason for our lengthy exile and our present predicament. Clearly, he does not mean that we should learn how to wage war and conquer lands while in exile. That would be impossible, for our dispersion among the nations has made us weak. That obligation to learn war and land conquest, that obligation only applied when we were together in our land. Besides which, we are bound by oath not to go up to Israel Kechoma as a wall. See the famous Gemara in Ksubas 111a. We spent a lot of time on that Gemara back in the day before we took a look at our book. So, we continue. Our dispersion among the nations has made us weak. The Rambam states that this is the reason for our lengthy exile and our present predicament, that we have not studied warfare and land conquest. Hiram Abrilov, welcome. We have a very strange situation right now. We are temporarily not in our room, but that's okay. God willing, next week. I'll continue reading and pardon my back. Undoubtedly, the Rambam means that we should use the natural means that become available to us, and we should not rely on miracles alone. For example, we should ask the kings to show us kindness in order to end our exile. We should, quote, conquer, end quote, conquer the land by acquiring it. You know what that means? Buying it. And here's his footnote. Our brilliant and righteous master, Rabbi Tzvi Kalischer, discusses this at length in his Sefer Drishat Zion. But the editors of our book write, we were unable to locate this source. At all events, he also continues in that footnote, other Gaonim discussed it as well. And they cite the Yerushalmi in Moed Katan, chapter 2, halacha 4, to prove that buying land from the Gentiles is like conquering the land, and that it's a mitzvah to redeem the land of Israel from their hands. See the Rivash, which I cited above in the Haskamas on page 19. Also see Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, by the great Gaon, our master, Yonadav Blumberg of Dvinsk, printed in 1898. And so that's a way of conquering the land of Israel, buying it, acquiring it, and taking it out of the hands of the Gentiles. And we should engage in other natural endeavors, he writes. Then, if we do that, Hashem will send us heavenly assistance. He will bring us to our land, and he'll put an end to our exile. I'm now on the top of page 274. However, Rabbi Tachtel writes, if we do nothing, then the Rambam's words from his tshuva to the rabbis of Marseille, and this is what the Rambam wrote, quote, this is what prolonged our exile and brought us to our present predicament. You know, their study of astrology, said the Rambam. The nothingness of astrology is what prolonged our exile, brought us to our present predicament. If we do nothing, then the Rambam's words of prolonging exile and present predicament will pertain to us. That is to say, we will have only ourselves to blame for the lengthy exile and for our present predicament. We are abandoned like the fish of the sea. Anyone can do to us as he pleases. And our blood is spilled like water due to our numerous sins, he writes in parens. May Hashem help us recognize the truth. And at the end, he's going to end with fighting words for the Haredim. But here is his hope. May Hashem help us recognize the truth. And may he arouse the people of Israel to once again long for their mother's bosom, a reference to the land of Israel, and work towards this goal. Here are the fighting words against his co-religionists. May he open the eyes of those who have been blinded by Satan's false and unfounded claims, which clearly contradict Chazal's words. Well, them's fighting words. Satan's false and unfounded claims have blinded the eyes of those who don't agree with him and who, in his opinion, disagree with Chazal. Really something. I'll take questions and comments. Rabbi Berloff goes first.
The only comment is that anybody who's read anything of the Sattler and it's true of any of his, co-travelers, they're not shy about using the term satan and similar terms. So it looks like, I'm just as an outsider, as a third party who's taking a long look at the controversy, it's obvious that once either side has made a decision as to what's right, so any shita, any opinion that is in contradiction to what one has decided is correct, is the shita of Satan. You know, it's very easy to throw that word around. But what I find it interesting, though, is that I think in the early Shabbos, I think Rabbi Farkas brought that up. Ezuhu machlokes, l'shem shamayim, maybe brought it up in Shom Shus, machlokes hilo l'shamayim. That the idea that there could be a machlokas on this very vitally important point and everything that goes with it, and yet this machlokas could still be the same shamayim, that neither side are being duped by Satan, but they're simply using their divine-given but human reason to reach a conclusion which is not the only possible conclusion from the sources. To be quick to label the opposing side following Satan, I'm not so sure that is rationally the ear within Jewish tradition the best way to go.
Thank you very much, but it certainly is the most exciting, fun way to go, to label your friends, your rivals, your opponents, as under the influence of the Satan, and to demonize them. That they're either Rishayim, or in this case, to be very charitable, to call them merely blind.
The Satan blinded.
Right. The Satan is blinded.
Right.
Blinded by Satan's false and unfounded claims, which clearly contradict Chazal's words. In the same way that, as Rabbi Berloff said, he doesn't need to pile on, but I like piling on. That's why I get paid the big bucks over here. The fact is that in ancient times, there were differences of opinion, and we spent our whole life reading them and studying them. And that was true not just in the times of the Tanayim, but in the Amorayim, the Rishonim, and the Gaonim, and the Achronim, and today. And so it is mostly sharp. It's most clearly perceived in sharply scene in this Israel machlokes as to how to understand the state of Israel. Because it is a conundrum wrapped in an enigma. I have with me right now, I found it, Rabbi Nissen Wolfen, on the 50th anniversary of the State of Israel's founding, he wrote an essay in the Jewish Observer. So naturally, yours truly made a copy of that, thinking that I was going to have to go ahead and write and read this one of these days. So this is from the Jewish Observer of May 1998. He writes, reflections on 50 years since the declaration of the state. The truth is that this requires a separate class to read it and hack it around and you know, enjoy it and get to the bottom of it. He's a shtickl critical. He's a shtickl, you know, celebratory in a slight way. But you know what? He certainly writes the following. He certainly writes. Let me get to this all-important one. Let me just get to it. Where he quotes down the Chazon Ish. Okay, one second. I know that I saw it over here. Because the Chazon Ish has it's a very long essay. Okay, I'm going to just read for a second. And I know that my time is a little bit shortened today. We're going to end at 2:10 because I got to pick up my kid and go. But I'm going to give you a little treat. If you have the Jewish Observer of May 1998 in front of you, I can't believe you could ever have it handy. But if you're on page 28, I'll do the reading. As the Chazon Ish is known to have said, are we all listening to this? As the Chazon Ish is known to have said, the emergence of the Medina is an enigma, a puzzle which defies authoritative definition. That alone, those four lines, or whatever it is that comes up in the print, that one sentence is an amazing thing for the Chazon Ish to have been known to have said. It says that the emergence of the Medina, I'll read it again, is an enigma, a puzzle which defies authoritative definition. I don't want to put anybody, I don't want to ambush Rabbi Brola, but if you want to weigh in, feel free. If you want to hold your horses, I'll read another line or two, and we'll go on. But if you want to weigh in, you're welcome to.
Now, is that okay. The end of the quote for Chazon Ish?
Yes.
Then I will weigh in now.
Okay. Yeah, then he's going to say that there's been a phenomenal growth of Torah in the Yishuv over the past 50 years. But the Chazon Ish's quote is what it is. Go ahead.
It is known, I don't know the details of everybody where they stood, but within the large center of the Torah leadership, that means center excluding people with a satmar and a Torah character philosophy on one side and people with a national religious philosophy on the other, but in the middle that's certainly broadly represented by Agudas Yisrael, there was a vast spectrum of opinions. And on the right, although he was not in Agudas Yisrael, but somewhere bridging between the Aguda and the Satmar and the Torah Karta, or in Haredes, let's say, Torah Karta might be extreme, more extreme, was the Brisker Rav. I'm pretty sure that he did not break the precedent of his father, who, after one bad experience, did not continue affiliation with Agudas Yisrael. Brisker Rav held almost like Satmar, except that he disagreed with following the various violent or aggressive forms of protest that Sefer Hasidim, but that's not to speak of the Torah Karta, and I know him for following. He was very much against it, but he was just against the protest because he was afraid that the Zionists would not stop at murder. He said that, killing. In any case, his ideology was very, very close to that side, and the reason that's important to us is because in the mainline Haredi community, he is recognized as an undisputed Gadol Hador in a very, very big way. You know, the shiur that some of us heard Sunday in the Cincinnati Kollel was basically an analysis of his Torah. On the other hand, you had the Gera Rebbe, who, while in other ways Gera Hasidus is might be seen as extreme when it comes to Zionism, they were somewhat accommodating and positive to the extent that I believe that the ultimate breakup between the Degel HaTorah and other factions of the Aguda that remained within the organization was actually because the Gera Rebbe and some of others, mostly Hasidish, had a view which was much more warm towards the state than the other fashions. Now, where the Chazon Ish comes in the spectrum, I never learned for a fact, but the quote that you just cited would seem to support what I've long assumed, that he was somewhere in the middle. You know, he was not within the Agud, not extreme on either side. On one hand, he would even consider saying Tachanun if he was the Sandek on a Hey Iyar, just even though you're not supposed to have Tachanun when one of the three celebrants of the Bris is there, but not to, you know, confuse people. On the other hand, for example, he was supportive of Chadorim in Hebrew rather than in Yiddish, where the clientele was, or I should say, when it would be more appropriate for the potential students, because they would understand if written not Yiddish. It was very practical that way, where I'm sure the Sattva would have had something very, very different to say about that. The Chazon Ish, he was, I think, the halachic advisor to the Poalei Aguda Kibbutzim and Moshafim. He was somewhat moderate in some ways within that aspect. So it does not surprise me at all, it goes along with that he expressed the ambivalent or confused view about what the Medina meant.
As opposed to the very, very clear-cut Satmar approach, that this is absolutely bad news, and the alternating, contrasting, clear view of Rav Kook and his progeny, that this is the best thing ever.
Right. Let's also bear in mind that when the Medina was declared and there was a declaration of independence, that the people who drafted it went around to the leaders of the various parties, factions, to sign when the Aguda were approached. So they immediately now won't know what to do. I think there was some kind of a high-level hubbubs within their Torah leadership, and the decision was, and you can find their signature on there, Agud Yisrael signed on the declaration of the State of Israel. So how then could they say there was a horrible thing that should never have been? You know, they would be putting their foot in their mouth a little bit.
Right, and Rabbi Berloff, historically, isn't it the case that with the Balfour Declaration, they did kind of come around, and that sort of offended Satmar so much, and therefore for them the good is anathema. Prior to that, there was seemingly this almost monolithic Haredi and Yeshivish opposition to the Zionists. And then with the Balfour Declaration, that seemed to have caused a fissure within that camp, and that's what angered the Satmar so much, is how I understood it. And so you had this this kind of ambivalent, okay, seemingly this is the hand of God kind of approach. All right, we'll go on with it, we'll go along with it, on the part of the Aguda, which the Satmars could never, ever reconcile. They could never countenance that. And so they just, you know, never dealt with Aguda again. That was my understanding. Is it fair to say that might also be your understanding as to how the history kind of worked its way out, that the Balfour Declaration was seemingly this distinctive thing that caused this rupture within the Haredi Judaism in Israel?
I have to plead ignorance to some extent, but broadly speaking, you're definitely 100% correct, this much I know. Let's, in terms of the Agud Yisrael as an organization, they only were founded a very few short years before the Balfour Declaration, about 1914, just before World War I, Aguda started, the early to mid-teens. And the Balfour Declaration was right after World War I, right?
23, maybe? Or
no, I think it wasn't until like 18 or something like that. I believe so. And it wasn't much time for the Aguda to take, to gel before the Balfour Declaration came into existence. Mm-hmm. I do know certain things, and that can be looked up, that there were certain Haredim, like a young Rabbi Yochanan Teitelbaum, who was already becoming known. Of course, he didn't in any way have anything close to the fame, prestige, and leadership or followership, I should say, that he developed as the years went by. But he was very much against Aguda. I'm not sure of the entire reason why Reb Chaim Brusker was intimated to attend only one Knesset Gedola, one convention, would not come back. I think part of it, he was a little bit anti-Yekish. He was not impressed, to say politely, with the great cover that the Western European, the so-called Frankfurt faction of Aguda was given, notwithstanding that the amount of Torah scholars from there was probably a lot less than other areas. But the fissure, I think it continued, and it might have been as late as the 30s, definitely well before the Second War. But in the late 30s, when the Turkey Karta actually, you know, broke, and I don't know how the Eidah Haredes fits into that good Israel. That's one of my big mysteries that I'm not sure. I know that I wasn't here to soil in the early 70s, so I was a little bit closer to the situation. Aguda to soil had its own kashrus. It wasn't very big, but had it as independent of either the Rabbanut or the Eidah Haredes, but the very right wing. And I don't know if the entire Eidah Haredes is part of it, or I never fully understood if the Torah Kadra also part of the Eidah Haredes and just their own supplementary fish or not, but the very right wing blamed the Aguda. I saw a pamphlet and they were sold out to the Rabbanut and the Kashrus. They worked together with the Rabbanut, notwithstanding that the officials were separate, et cetera, et cetera. So what I read was actually that in the 30s, as the thunder rain clouds were thickening in Europe, and anybody with any common sense could see that the Derech HaTev, barring any divine intervention, I mean, everything's divine in terms of the plan of the world, but, you know, non-natural intervention by God, that things are going to be going rapidly from bad to worse. Maybe some may have imagined how bad. I don't know if anybody really fully could fathom what actually happened. In any case, it seems that the Aguda, for practical reasons, did things to encourage Aliyah. For an example, they tried to get as many of the precious few Aliyah certificates, as we know that how greatly restricted they were, the British tried to get as many as they possibly could. But I'm almost sure that they needed to work with the Jewish agency, or whatever the group was called then, who worked directly with the British government. They had to work with them to try to get their crumbs, to get the few as many visas as they would be allowed, many slots they would be allowed. When the Aguda had their share within the general idea, if not the official umbrella of a new Aliyah, you know, certain youth villages and similar programs that were run 100% al Taharas HaKodesh, and they want, if at all possible, at least those children who were being rescued, who came from homes, should be placed in firm institutions. And the establishment begrudgingly gave a percentage to the Mizrahi institutions, which the Aguda didn't consider firm enough. And the Aguda tried to get what they could. So they had to work, you know, in practical terms. In the San Francisco Hirsch School, the commonly known, you know, the broader community school, which founded and named after Social Paul Hirsch, that my mother and her mother before attended, Aleihem Shalom. I remember asking my mother as an elementary school child if when she learned Hebrew, did they learn Havaras Faradit, like they speak in Israel as we learned in school, or was Aver Ashkenazis, as my mother would daven and so on. And she said, the basic Lubude Kodesh program was always for Ashkenazis. But at least in the last 2 years, and they left, that family left in the end of 37. So you're not dealing with the very, you're dealing with towards the end, but not the very end. The last 2 years that she was in school there, at a separate time slot, a separate course they had, maybe even once a week, they had, later she told me, it was called Hachshara. And it was like Ulpan, it was within the framework actually of the Aguda identified Breuers or her school, there was a hachshara where they taught Ulpan style, I believe, modern Ivrit, for the obvious practical reason of many, you know, many of them were going, whoever could. I don't say whoever could, but, you know, many of them were going. And they had to be able to cope. So, again, that was accommodation. So, of course, the ones who would follow the opinion of the Satmar would say that this accommodation is selling out, is treason. You know, it's you know, selling out your principles. So at a certain point, I think there was even a machlokes, if I'm not mistaken, within the well-known rabbinic Blau family, that one of the Blau, was it of Amram Blau, was one of the co-founders of the Turi Karta.
Right.
I don't know, I think he was the one who later had his second marriage. But there was also, I believe, either a brother or a cousin with the same last name who remained within the mainstream, mainstream Haredim. So again, I don't know where Haredi Haredis fits in with Aguda, but I believe it tore apart families. And you know, I don't know. Nobody's been able to tell me how it works in Israel today. If in Be'er Sha'arim and many other similar neighborhoods, you must have some people who are on both sides of that divide, and yet look from the outside, they look the same. You know, those who hold it's a mitzvah to go to the polls and vote for the Frum Party. It has to be whichever Frum Party is endorsed by their group at the moment. I mean, there was an example in the early 50s, Paul A. Aguda was attracted quite a number of people, and Paul A. Aguda was, you know, kind of a little bit more accommodating than the regular Aguda. It was sort of halfway between Aguda and Mizrahi, and the scarer, Rebbe, made a declaration, anybody who is found with a membership card of the Curse of Paul A. Aguda organization will be denied any privileges at a care stable, can't be Aliyah, can't come from it, and so on. But still, these groups hold that it's a very big mitzvah to vote. Not only the mitzvah for the men to vote, most of them will say, since among the fry, the non-religious, the women vote, so obviously in order to have any chance of any kind of a balance of numbers, so among their group, the women as well have to vote. And then you have those who say that voting in an Israeli election is a horrible, horrible avera.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they must be living in the same neighborhoods. I don't know if they attend the same schools, you know, or down in the same city. I just don't know. I'm curious to find out. You know, these are just things that sometimes they argue about at the, on the table or across the table, but they don't interfere with normal social, can I say the word intercourse, which all it means is, you know, getting people relate to each other. That's all the word means. Or are they very different factions? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure. I do know this much, that my daughter, who with her family, very Haredi, would live, now they're in Beitar Elit, send their kids to a Hebrew cheder.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told, I was told by my son-in-law, there are also Yiddish chadorim there. I asked him, what's the difference, other than obvious language difference? He says, those that send their kids to the Yiddish cheder, or chadorim, are generally in favor of greater social isolation. In other words, they don't want their kids to mingle with other kids their age who attend Hebrew Chadorim, who are, may not be pure enough for them as potential Chavir. Notwithstanding, you're dealing with kids of payas, and these kids are, who are learning almost all day, the boys, exclusion of secular, and
sure,
everything else that we would imagine goes with it. But they don't want their kids associating with these kids.
Right.
So I just don't know how it is today.
I love that one-upsmanship that we just cannot seem to shake. Thank you, Rabbi Roller, for that discussion. I remember reading the Rabbi Yosef Kahanim and the Panovitcher Rav at the very beginnings of the State of Israel. If my reading is accurate, he would fly the Israeli flag on top of the yeshiva on Yom HaAtzmaut. And also, I believe, was it Rabbi Sarna or some other Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron Yeshiva, also took a very pro approach to the nascent State of Israel. They were not the only ones, but that was back 70 years ago. Things have changed over the past 70 years, and you seem to see somehow this almost monolithic now negative approach, and again, you know, not 101%, but I don't know if they're flying the flag in Panovich anymore. I kind of doubt that. And Hebron's an interesting place for all kinds of reasons, but I don't know if they're flying the flag or whatever. So I just wanted to throw that out for your thoughts. I appreciate very, very much your input, Rav Rola. That's great. That's the Chazon Ish. His ambivalence is right out there. And we're going to continue. It is a most fascinating article. Probably does deserve its own few minutes, and we could do that as we...
Think about Hebron, if you want to finish. Because Yom Yerushalayim yesterday. Hebron was the yeshiva of Hebron in Yerushalayim, an absolutely miraculous thing that happened to, I don't remember the details, on Yerushalayim, an absolute Yeshua, an absolute salvation. And to commemorate that, for many years afterwards, on Yom Yerushalayim, they had a Sudas Hodoi, a meal, a special meal of Thanksgiving, a special Sudas Mitzvah. I asked someone, Yeshua Rabinstein, who should have a Refuah Shleima on it, good. I asked him years ago, after he had gone to Hebron, do they have that, still have that Suda every, you know, on Yom Yerushalayim? He gave me this look, and I said, no. I said, don't think they abolished it, they don't do it. And I asked him why. That's, I think, when he gave me the look, you know, I mean, how could they, you know, right, celebrate Yom Yerushalayim?
And how could you possibly celebrate Yom Yerushalayim and be within the Yeshiva Shekamp? I got a little clip the other day. My brother sent me over a clip of the Kotel, and it was jam-packed with white, you know, kippah shrugot and taletot. And they're davening, they're saying ho hallel. So I have that in my phone over here, and I showed it to my wife, and it really is quite something to see. You will not find a black hat in that crowd. This is Yom Yerushalayim that we're celebrating after all. So there's much to say about this. We're living in the most fascinating times. We are a fractured people philosophically in this matter, and that's what makes it so interesting and so amazing and fascinating to me. We have a little bit more time left or so we're going to hop on every second we can. We're on the eve of Shavuos. So we continue, okay? We're on page 274. We'll do another 7 minutes or so. And as I said, I need to get out to Mount Washington, so we're going to leave a little bit early. Page 274, kind of like in the middle, on the left-hand side. The bold, our redemption depends on the redemption of the land. Our geula, he's going to quote a Mekubal, our geula depends upon our redeeming the Holy Land of Israel. Listen to this. Commenting on the pasuk, quote, this is pasuk in Vayikra, the land shall not be sold permanently. This is pasuk in Vayikra, chapter 25, verse 23. The land should not be sold permanently. He quotes the brilliant and godly Kabbalist Rabbi David Lida, who writes that, quote, our redemption depends on the redemption of the land, and our subjugation depends on its subjugation. And the citation for that is the Sefer Ir Miklat on Mitzvah 335, page 38a, citing a rabbi, the Moharamash, but it's unclear to whom he is referring, writes the editor. At all events, this is Rabbi David Lida, I'm a Kubel, and here we go, that our redemption is going to depend upon our redeeming the land of Israel. Similarly, the Ramban cites Yerushalmi, he writes, which in this very Taichtal, quoting the Ramban, citing Yerushalmi, which indicates that we must not let our land remain in Gentile hands forever. And he's quoting that on a Demai, in a Mishnah in Demai, or rather in a Yerushalmi, Gemara in Yerushalmi, Demai, see Perek 5, Halacha 9. He concludes, Rabbi David Lida concludes, but over here inside, the Ramban is the Pirish on Sefer HaMitzvos, Negative Commandment 227. This is the Ramban. Quote, this implies a law, a prohibition. Mustn't let our land remain in Gentile hands. So the implication is that there's some sort of prohibition about allowing it to remain in Gentile hands. You're not allowed to do that. Can't let them have it. This implies a law, a prohibition, that we may not leave the land permanently in the hands of the Goyim. The reason for this is as follows. If we sell our bodies to the Gentiles, we are commanded to regain them from their possession. And the Torah explains why. You know why? Because the children of Israel are servants to me, Hashem says. Kili, you know, Kili, what's the pasuk? Avodah b'nei Israel. Avodahem, the children of Israel are servants to me.
Israel,
Avodahem, yeah. Wait, the pasuk in Vayikra chapter 25, verse 55. Children of Israel are servants to me, not to anybody else, says God. Similarly, we are commanded to take possession of the land of Israel and not leave it in their hands, in the hands of the non-Jews. The Torah gives the same reason here as it does in reference to our bodies. That is, because the land belongs to God, He doesn't want to settle anyone there but us. Therefore, it will return to us. And now he gives us a footnote in his sefer, Drishat Tzion, Rabbi Kalischer explains that nowadays the mitzvah of conquering the land is primarily accomplished through acquisition, through purchase. We're not able to locate this source, we're told also by the editor. This concurs with Tosfos. See Tosfos in Kedushin, Gemara Kedushin, page 26a, on the Dibra Maskil, the word Omar. So we have this idea that we've got to buy back the land of Israel bit by bit from the non-Jews. That is the way to redeem the land of Israel by acquisition, by purchase, and get it back into Jewish possession. We'll do one more paragraph. It's on the next page. Please follow me over to page 275. First paragraph on the top. This Ramban sheds light on Rabbi David Lieder's statement that our redemption depends on the redemption of the land of Israel, and our subjugation depends on on the land of Israel's subjugation. He says, this seems difficult. Why should they depend on one another? Now, however, it's clear, writes Rabbi Teichtal. The Ramban writes that Hashem insists that we regain the land from the hands of the Goyim, of the Gentiles, just like we are commanded to regain Jewish bodies from their possession. Therefore, when we don't care to regain the land of Israel from their possession, so we're punished. Then we're punished, midah keneged midah, measure for measure. And our bodies as well are subjugated to them. However, if we strive to regain the land of Israel from their possession, then our bodies will also deserve to go free. This is true and clear with Hashem's help. And that's the connection. If we go out of our way to reclaim and reacquire the land of Israel through purchase, then Hashem says, okay. So now you yourself also will be redeemed physically, and you will no longer have to be subjugated in a physical manner because you have physically redeemed the land. So you yourselves personally, in your own person, can now also be redeemed and free to go about. It's a midah keneged midah understanding, according to the Ramban, and it's shot upon this understanding of the Yerushalmi and Rabbi David Lieder, and all this whole big ball of wax comes down to redeeming the land of Israel, and then we ourselves get redeemed. My dear friends, I'm so sorry. Last thought? If not, we're going to get going. I'm going to thank everybody for allowing me to bug out a little bit earlier than I normally do. I want to wish everybody a very successful week as you prepare for Shavuos. Have a very good Chodesh Tov, a good Chodesh tonight and tomorrow. And enjoy, get ready for Kabbalah Satorah. Please join us Tuesday night for Tanakh Tuesdays. Unless you're baking cheesecake, maybe you've got a heter. Otherwise, I'll see you, God willing, Tuesday night. For now, we'll learn Sefer Malachim and get ready even further for Kabbalah Satorah. Wishing everybody a good day and a good Chodesh. Shmuel Plotzker signing off from Gulf Manor Synagogue in Cincinnati. Have a great day and a good evening. If you're in Israel, all best. Kol Tov, Chodesh Tov. Bye-bye.